This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. For the next couple of weeks, you might feel trapped inside two political campaign infomercials, first for the Republicans and then for the Democrats. But when most people step back from the political process, they're not that happy with it. They think it consumes vast resources and produces just too little. And that unhappiness extends to former politicians, presidential aides, and chiefs of staff. So what if you could reinvent the American political system and create something that really works? How would you do it? Join me on the line is Mark McKinnon, Vice Chairman of Hill and Knowlton Strategies, former advisor to George W. Bush, and a co-founder of the group No Labels. Mark McKinnon, thanks for joining us.
Hey, glad to join you.
And we're also joined by Bill Galston, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and former aide to President Clinton. And he's also a co-founder of No Labels. Bill Galston, thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
So, Mark McKinnon, let me start with you, but this question is really for both of you. One of the questions that I have as we sort of look at this week in Tampa and then we gear up for the Democratic Convention is, what are the issues that we won't be talking about? One that has sort of surfaced in my mind over the last few days is the issue of Afghanistan. We hear news from there almost all the time, very often Americans being killed, but it just does not seem to have penetrated. It's not part of commercials. I doubt it's going to be a big part of anybody's speeches. So, Mark McKinnon, what for you are the issues that are just sort of MIA at these conventions?
Well, a lot of important issues are either MIA or they're being talked about in extraordinarily hyper-partisan ways. In other words, where people are saying, you know, the Republicans want to do it our way or the highway. Same thing with the Democrats. They're looking past each other and more interested in scoring political points than achieving any kind of real progress for the country. Of course, we're focused now on economic concerns, and that pushes issues like Afghanistan to the back burner. But what we're doing at No Labels is there's a lot of contentious issues out there, Medicare, Afghanistan, many, many others, immigration. And the parties have different positions on those. The problem that we have today is that the parties aren't talking to one another. They actually run for Congress saying that they won't, if elected, they will not compromise under any circumstances. And that's a problem because that's what legislating and governing is all about. It's giving a little so you can move the country forward. It's not just scoring points for the party. So what we've done is said, listen, there's a lot of reforms, process kind of reforms that will help bring members of Congress together to do the job that they're supposed to be doing. People just want Congress to work. I mean, most Americans, you know, they identify as a Republican or a Democrat, but they're not hyper-partisans. They want the Congress to actually work. So we've come up with a whole list of reforms that aren't really very controversial. This isn't over how you fund Medicare. This is whether or not presidents can appoint people to do their jobs within 90 days and not have the government not have their jobs filled for 4 years. So I'm glad to talk about a number of those issues that we've outlined to both reform the presidency and the Congress.
Yeah, and we will do that. I mean, it includes everything from just sort of showing up for the job to making sure you don't get paid if you can't come up with a budget. But I want to touch a little bit first on some of what you think is wrong. Bill Galston, do you see issues when you look at these conventions that you feel like are just not being touched on?
Sure do. The single biggest issue that isn't being touched on is the fact that right now we have a dysfunctional national government. It doesn't matter who you are or what you believe in, the odds are huge that it's not going to happen because a government that was designed for a very different political epoch is frozen in obsolete rules and procedures and relationships that are thwarting action anywhere and everywhere. That is the number one problem. There are lots of other problems that aren't being talked about and are unlikely to be talked about sensibly. Let's talk about the economy for a minute. We don't just have a lingering recession. In my judgment, which I think is pretty widely shared, the American economy suffers from structural problems that need to be addressed structurally and in a way that is much less partisan than the way it's being discussed right now.
And when you say
until we can have that kind of discussion, I think we're not going to have the kind of economy and the kind of country we want.
When you say structural, are you sort of talking about the growth in, let's say, healthcare spending that nobody seems to be dealing with in any kind of comprehensive way? Is it that sort of looking at the pattern of how we're spending our money and seeing that it just cannot be continued forever?
It's not just how we're spending our money. In the past generation, there's been a huge shift in the circumstances of the American economy. Billions of new people have entered the labor market.
Mm-hmm.
Many countries that were nowhere in the world economy 20 years ago are now big players. That's affecting every American household. It's affecting American wages. It's affecting American exports. It's affecting the capacity of firms here at home to compete with foreign firms. That fact is not going away. The Chinese, the Indians, the Brazilians, and others who have entered the global marketplace, not to mention the former Soviet Union, are there to stay. And I don't think our political system has even begun to come to grips with the implications of this momentous shift. I could go on for 45 minutes, but that's not what we're here to discuss. But that's a big deal.
Mark McKinnon, you interestingly have gone from sort of the political realm to private business. And I wonder if your sense is what Bill Galston says, that sort of the business community feels like neither the Democrats nor the Republicans are up to dealing with the kind of really tough problems that the business community simply has to face. You know, if you're the head of GE, you have to deal with it, even if the president doesn't.
Absolutely right. And they look at Congress and their jaws drop in disbelief and shock, because they understand, as do most Americans, that there are very obvious things that need to be done. They recognize that there needs to be a combination of new revenue and cuts. You know, but in Washington, you know, one party believes in one believes in the other, and nobody can agree that there needs to be a mix of those elements in order to achieve any sort of progress for the country. But any businessman and any corporation will tell you that's exactly what we have to do, and it's fairly obvious.
Now, you said before that you think most people in the country, even if they say I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat, they're not hyper-partisan. So let me ask you about one of the trends that certainly we see happening here in the Northeast. You see these sort of endangered, of course, Northeastern Republicans. It's the same you see endangered Southern Democrats, right? Olympia Snow is leaving. Arlen Specter's already gone. Scott Brown is our senator here in Massachusetts, but obviously in a close fight. Susan Collins from Maine does remain around. But you have seen a real sort of diminution of that constituency, the sort of Northeastern conservative, fiscally conservative Republican. So I wonder if maybe the Congress that we have is a reflection of who we are. We are a polarized country.
No, it's really not. And I count myself among that lonely caucus of progressive Republicans that are disappearing in Congress, but they're not disappearing in the country. The reason that that's happening in Congress is because we have the redistricting that we call gerrymandering, where they find districts that are safer for strong Republicans, safer for Democrats. There are all kinds of reforms that we need to put in place to change the actual representation in Congress, because it doesn't reflect the broad middle of America.
Bill Galston, let me pick up on that gerrymandering issue, because I know that's one of the things that No Labels has talked about. And I think people think, whatever, who cares how we draw, you know, districts and congressional seats. But the idea of gerrymandering really matters. How you draw a congressional district really matters. How?
Well, let me back up a step. We can have a long, interesting political science discussion about whether the American people are more polarized than they were a generation ago. I think the answer to that question is probably yes. But the fact that matters for the current discussion is that the American people are not nearly as polarized as the two major political parties are. Hmm. And that's what generates this sense of non-representation that so many tens of millions of Americans are now feeling. And even people, rank-and-file people who are staunch Democrats and staunch Republicans, are readier to look for compromise and common ground than are their representatives in Congress. And that links up with the question that you've just raised about congressional districts. If lines are drawn to produce strong majorities in a congressional district for one party or the other, then the real contest isn't the general election. It's the primary, the party primary.
Right.
And a lot of people are forced to cast votes they don't really believe in because they know that if they vote their consciences, that someone to their right, if they're Republicans, or someone to their left, if they're Democrats, are likely to challenge them the next time around in their party primaries. And you've seen that happen, interestingly, at the senatorial level as well, which means that we're not just talking about line drawing. But it is nonetheless the fact that we are the only advanced democracy where politicians choose their voters rather than the other way around. This is really anomalous, and it's hard to believe that we wouldn't be better off if we changed it.
Now, I know Iowa, I think, has been in the forefront of trying to change it. Have there been sort of experiments in alternative drawing of lines that have really worked?
Well, Iowa was one of the early adopters of a less partisan system, an independent commission, I believe. And Iowa does have a larger share of genuinely competitive congressional districts than most other states. Having said that, I think it's important not to put too much weight on the theme of gerrymandering and line drawing, because the simple fact is that when you look at counties and states, they're more polarized than they were 30 years ago, and it's impossible to attribute that to shifting boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
So there is evidence, and sociologists have produced it, that a lot of Americans are voting with their feet, and they're choosing to live near other like-minded people. We cherish our diversity nationally, but we don't always enjoy it locally, and we sometimes act to reduce it.
That's really interesting that people are reorganizing themselves by sort of belief system. We're talking about reinventing politics with Mark McKinnon, former advisor to George W. Bush and a co-founder of the group No Labels, and Bill Galston, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and former aide to President Clinton. He's also a co-founder of No Labels. And Mark McKinnon, let's get into, you've got sort of at No Labels, you've got two ways of sort of reinventing, totally rethinking the way things are done in Washington. One is ways to make Congress work, and one is ways to make the presidency work, and they're very intertwined. But let's talk about Congress first, because I think,
Okay. First
of all, people think very little of their Congress people. Gallup did a poll. The percentage of people who think that Congress is doing the right thing only some of the time or none of the time is now over 80%. Let's talk about some things to make Congress work. And I thought one of the really interesting things is no budget, no pay. Currently, people have some really long vacations in Congress. How do you fix that?
Well, not only long vacations. In fact, we just discovered that the House of Representatives this year has worked 150 hours less than they did in years past, and the Senate has worked 100 hours less at a time when we have some of our most pressing problems that we've ever faced. So no budget, no pay is an idea that's getting enormous traction. And we've already got 90 co-sponsors and sponsors in the House and the Senate and a huge grassroots movement behind it because it's so obvious and logical. First of all, the budget drives policy in Washington. Second of all, we have a system in which our representatives keep pushing it off. The Senate hasn't even passed a budget in 3 or 4 years. The only time they passed a budget on time, the Congress, I think, is twice in the last 40 years. And they keep passing these budget resolutions that just push things forward. So it's not a real budget. And therefore, we don't get policy. And so our idea is simply, if you don't come up with a budget on time, then you don't get paid. And for every day that you don't pass the budget, you get docked more pay. And that's pretty much how the rest of America works. If you don't show up to your job and you don't do your job, you don't get paid. So we think this is actually a very attractive idea that's getting a lot of support out in the country.
And there's this kind of, do you feel like the no pay part would create a real serious incentive for people to do whatever they need to do, either to stay in D.C., not go back to their home districts, work across the aisle? Would that be enough of an incentive?
I think absolutely it would. I mean, if you're, you know, there are a lot of members of Congress, granted, that don't need the money, but there are a lot that do. And if you're one of those that do, and you've got a paycheck that's contingent on a budget being passed, you're going to go to your committee chairman or the leadership in the party and say, hey, keep us in town. I've got a mortgage to pay just like other working Americans, and we've got to pass a budget so I can get a paycheck.
You know, interestingly, Bill Galston, I think one of the problems with people coming up with budgets, it ties into another point that you make, another way to make Congress work, which is people not taking pledges apart from their oath of office. And certainly we've heard a lot in the discussion around the budget of these pledges that people made to Grover Norquist, saying that they would never, ever in their career raise taxes. And that includes enhancing revenue from any sort of source, including closing loopholes. How detrimental are those kinds of pledges to the political system that we have now?
Well, we at No Labels think it's very detrimental because it thwarts the solutions that we know as a country we need to agree on and implement. If you look at our fiscal situation, No Labels has been arguing now for more than a year that we cannot hope to solve the problem unless everybody is at the table and everything is on the table. But the whole point of these pledges is to take things off the table. And so right at the threshold, the predicate, the necessary condition for compromise, for progress, for agreement is eliminated. So this, you know, this may seem like an obscure problem, but it's the heart of the matter. If people at the party, in each political party, out of conviction or out of fear that somebody's going to oppose them in the next primary, say, oh, no, 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 I won't consider taxes, I won't consider any serious alterations in Medicare or Social Security, I won't consider a wide range of restraints that we're going to need and new ways of thinking. Well, that is a way of saying we'd rather stick with an impossible status quo than take the steps needed to solve the problems. So that's a big deal, and let me just put one other thing on the table. You asked Mark a couple of minutes ago, do we think no budget, no pay is an adequate incentive to make the progress on fiscal policy that we need? And we think it's an important incentive, but we also embrace what might be called a belt and suspenders strategy. So we also have a proposal that would require members of Congress to come to work. That is to say, we propose 5-day work weeks.
Seems simple enough.
For 3 weeks out of every four, and then they get a week at home to meet with their constituents, to raise money, whatever they need to do. But this idea that you can fly into Washington on Tuesday morning and fly out on Thursday evening and hope to get the people's business done is ridiculous, and everybody knows it. And to make matters worse, the House and the Senate don't even coordinate their schedules, so sometimes the House is in session when the Senate is out of session or vice versa, and that really complicates the legislative process, particularly when the two houses need to talk to one another, which they don't do nearly often enough.
And I think people don't actually realize that for representatives or senators whose congressional districts are, let's say, far away from D.C., they do very often work that sort of 3-day work week that you were describing, or maybe 2-plus work day, work week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it also, the other thing that I thought was interesting, too, that you try to encourage is these bipartisan seating, bipartisan leadership committees. I mean, one of the things that people talk about who've been around Washington for a long time, Mark McKinnon, is that it used to be that when people were there all week, there was a lot more socializing, so you didn't end up sort of thinking of the other guy so much as the villain because he was also somebody you saw socially, perhaps.
Absolutely right. It's so much easier to demonize people if you don't actually know them or haven't actually had to interact or work with them. And the reality that you just touched on is absolutely true. I've talked to members of Congress who literally will go through a whole session without talking to another member of the other party. So we've got a number of proposals in the, both the congressional and executive reform plan that require suggest that forums for leadership meetings and for members of the party to actually get to know one another. And again, that's that. It seems like perhaps just a symbolic touch, but it's really actually more than that, because there's lots of studies that are out there that show that when you actually interact with other people, it's a lot easier to get work done and to find consensus, even when you have differences of opinion.
Right, and it ties into what Bill was saying before about the country itself sort of segregating by belief. And if you have that in the Congress, then how are people ever going to potentially understand where somebody's coming from?
Exactly right. So we think that that's an important step in just getting them to get together so that they can begin to talk about these issues and start to make some progress.
Let me bring in the president here, who is in one of your 12 ways to make Congress work. You talk about bringing in question time for the president. And I'm going to play you a little clip, and then I'll go to you, Bill Galston. I'm going to play you a little clip from earlier this summer of British Prime Minister David Cameron answering questions from the opposition party in the House of Commons. You'll hear it gets a little raucous, but let's listen.
Mr. Speaker, we were in exactly the same position a year ago when initially he rejected the idea of a judge-led inquiry into the press scandal, and then he rightly changed his mind. In justifying that decision, he said this: "I don't believe there is any better process than an inquiry led by a judge." And he went on, "with the whole thing pursued by a team of barristers who are expert at finding out the facts." Mr. Speaker, why is it right to have this judge-led approach to the scandal in the press, but wrong for the scandal in the banks?
Yeah. Well, I think there is a very profound difference between the circumstances with the Leveson inquiry and the circumstances with this inquiry.
Bill Galston, there's a little piece of what goes on in London every week. The Prime Minister gets these really sort of tough questions. You can hear people sort of jeer at him or applaud. What is the advantage of bringing that to Congress, to the president?
Well, two things. First of all, there is an actual dialogue between the majority and the minority, the government and the opposition. And the leader of the government, the prime minister in Britain, or as we're recommending, the president of the United States, actually has to hear those tough questions and respond to them and do so in full view of the American people. And we believe deeply that government would work better if all parties are together in the same room. They're going to be partisan. They're going to hurl tough questions and charges at each other. But we're better off as a democracy if the leaders are actually hearing those questions and charges and responding to them. Number two, and you'll see this every week in question time in the British Parliament, when the leader of the government enters that room, he, or in the case of Margaret Thatcher, she, had better be really, really well briefed and up to date on everything that's going on in his or her administration. And that also contributes to better government. If you have to reach out constantly to people in the executive, what we call the executive branch, to find out what the problems are, what's going on, what are the really tough issues that the prime minister or the president ought to be aware of and ought to be prepared to speak to. That also is a force for better government.
Now, Mark McKinnon, you have been inside the White House. You know how carefully the president is handled. If we look at President Obama, obviously there's a lot of attention to making sure the press secretary, Jay Carney, says the right things. Can you imagine a scenario in which the president would agree to this, to be subject to the same kind of questions and have to come up with the sort of knowledge that David Cameron has to every single week?
Well, I think if you're a confident leader, you can be and you should be. And, you know, another one of the recommendations that we have is that there should be a press conference at least once a month. As you know, now modern presidents can go months and even years without having even a press conference. It's the obligation and the duty of the President of the United States to report regularly to the public. So we think that both of these are means by which that kind of dialogue can be facilitated. And, you know, we get enough support publicly for these kinds of measures, which is what we're doing, then it very often translates into actual action because people who are in government get a sense of which way the country's going and which way voters are moving, and they often will get drafted behind that movement.
Another thing I think that's really interesting is that you say, look, we all have to agree on a set of facts. We can have different opinions, but agreeing on a set of facts is really important. And I have to say, just so far this campaign, you have heard so many conflicting versions of the facts. And people often reference the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, as where their facts come from. But you still have a hard time understanding who is going to do what to what program. And I'm just, as an illustration, I'm going to play two ads for you. The first one will be a new Obama ad called Promises. It was released Saturday by the Obama campaign, and it essentially alleges that Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney will end Medicare. Let's listen to that first.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
It's a promise that was made long ago. You work hard, pay in, your Medicare benefits are guaranteed. But Mitt Romney would break that promise. Replace your benefits with a voucher. Insurance companies could just keep raising rates. Instead of a guarantee, seniors could pay $6,400 more a year. AARP says the plan Mitt Romney supports undermines Medicare. Mitt Romney, an end to the Medicare promise.
So here's a new President Obama ad saying, you know, Mitt Romney, if you like Medicare, you know, you should not vote for Mitt Romney. He's going to take it away. Here is an ad from the Romney campaign called Paid In. It was released August 14th. And it essentially says that President Obama has used Medicare money, stolen it, and used it for Obamacare. Let's listen.
You paid into Medicare for years. Every paycheck. Now when you need it, Obama has cut $716 billion from Medicare. Why? To pay for Obamacare. So now the money you paid for your guaranteed health care is going to a massive new government program that's not for you. The Romney-Ryan plan protects Medicare benefits for today's seniors and strengthens the plan for the next generation.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
So Mark McKinnon, here's the Romney campaign saying that the Obama people are taking money from a program that was for you and do it to a program that is not for you. You talked before about the sort of vast nonpartisan middle. How was anybody in that vast nonpartisan middle supposed to make any sense of these two ads?
Well, they can't. They can't. And that's the problem. It's no wonder why the American people are so confused and why they've lost so much trust in not only in government, but in the parties as well. That's why the Congress only has a 10% approval rating. But the parties don't, you know, people are leaving the parties in droves as well because they don't feel like anybody's telling them the truth anymore. So that's why we had this idea about a nonpartisan leader like the Comptroller General delivering on an annual basis a fiscal update, and that the president, the vice president, cabinet members, and everybody has to attend that. And I think there's a component of this proposal where we even have everybody has to sign off on it so that we have a common set of facts that everybody's dealing from in order to express their opinions.
Bill Galston, what do you make of these two ads and also the way in which people sort of twist the facts, even from organizations like the Congressional Budget Office that are sort of nominally not partisan?
Well, what makes this so hard, I think, for average listeners is that there are elements of truth in both of those ads. And what the political parties are doing and the campaigns are doing, they are cherry-picking the facts that are most friendly to their case. They're putting them forward, and they're ignoring the contrary facts that might help the other party more. And what the American people really need is a full and honest discussion of the question. Let's take Medicare as an example. There are some facts. The fact of the matter is that in the long run, the benefits that Medicare is now committed to paying vastly exceed the revenues now scheduled to come into the system. That's a fact. The Medicare actuaries make that statement every year, and people who study the policy know that's true. So then the question is, what are you going to do about that? If your course is unsustainable, by definition, you can't stay on it indefinitely. So when are we going to respond, and how are we going to respond? One possibility, of course, would be to keep the current program intact and to raise the revenues needed to fully fund it. And if you look out 20 or 30 years, we're talking about a very, very large increase in taxes needed to fund the Medicare program, a number so large that I think most Americans would recoil in horror and disbelief. So you then ask, well, what are the alternatives? One alternative is to keep the current structure of the program, but to reduce the benefits to a sustainable, more sustainable level, a level that can be sustained with the revenues that people are willing to put into it. And a third possibility is not so much to shrink the current program as to change its structure in ways that would reduce outlays over time, or some combination of those three. That, it seems to me, is a fair description of the long-term situation that we find ourselves in. But neither political party wants to put it exactly that way. And the Republicans are very eager to deny that there can be a revenue component to stabilizing Medicare for the long term. And the Democrats are equally unwilling to accept the possibility of a structural change, such as Romney and Ryan have proposed, and some Democrats have proposed as well.
So, Bill Galston, let's say, you know, none of the reforms that you have talked about are adopted for some reason, and we sort of continue on the way we are going right now. I mean, eventually, the numbers, as you say, become the reality. What is going to happen if neither Republicans nor Democrats deal with this in what you consider sort of a fiscally responsible way? What happens?
Well, what happened with every passing year that we don't deal with our long-term problems, it becomes more difficult to do so. And when we're right up against the impossibility of continuing, the abrupt changes that would be needed at that point would be very painful, very destabilizing, and would produce a popular revolt. And at that point, the people would say, why didn't anybody warn us? So our real choices are making modest changes now, putting us on a glide path to a better future, as opposed to continuing on its current course until, like the sort of the Roadrunner cartoons, you know, Wile E. Coyote is just walking along the cliff. He steps over the cliff. He keeps on walking on air. Then he looks down, and suddenly, down he goes,
right,
you know, in one fatal plunge. And it is that abrupt change in policies and in people's expectations that is, I think, the worst threat to come out of our gridlock right now.
Mark McKinnon, you talk about it, Known Labels, having this annual fiscal report to Congress. And I wonder, I mean, should we have somebody who is empowered to be even more important than that? You know, a sort of a Ross Perot kind of person, like you mentioned, a comptroller general, but somebody who like gets on C-SPAN with charts and says, look, this is how it's going. And here are the facts. You know, the Republicans, the Democrats, they can choose not to deal with them, but I'm here to make my annual or semi-annual or monthly report to you, the American people.
That's a good idea. I think we need to add one more bullet here on the plan, Bill. You know, I mean, it could be a person or maybe even, members of both parties that have been selected to a committee that is a permanent committee, has a permanent status and reports either annually or semi-annually. But I think that's a great idea.
I would point out, though, that our proposal already includes the fact that this fiscal report in our proposal annual has to be delivered to a joint session of Congress, And that officials from both the executive branch and the Congress have to attend, and that it would be nationally televised. So we're doing what we can, even within the framework of our own proposal, to ensure that this is not just a neutral scorekeeper, but someone who enjoys some real public visibility.
And Bill Galston, do you think there's any possibility that some of these hard facts, these hard truths that we've been talking about, are actually going to get touched on this year in the debates when there is a moderator who has access to those numbers and figures that are tough?
It depends on the skill and persistence of the moderator.
Mm-hmm.
And the willingness to make oneself unpopular with one or both candidates.
Right.
And as we see over and over again, when moderators or hosts of radio and television programs are determined to get candidates to answer questions that they really don't want to answer, things can get really sticky. And I think a lot of people in the media are reluctant to put themselves in that position because the media has credibility problems of its own. Not public radio, of course, but nearly everybody else. And so it's a tough job. But as the saying goes, somebody has to do it.
And Mark McKinnon, you know from obviously having advised a president that presidents are inclined, every president is, to give the sort of special big interviews to those people who they feel like have been nice to them in the past, which is why, of course, you see Mitt Romney doing a lot of Fox News interviews and you see Democrats doing a lot of MSNBC interviews. People want to go to friendly places. So I think, you know, as Bill Galston says, there is this danger, too, that the media figure who makes themselves an enemy of everybody, you know, risks the big interviews later on.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. But I do think the debates this year are going to be pivotal. And I think that they've got some very strong people moderating. And I think that there's going to be some very tough questions asked. And I think the American people are going to really be watching closely. I think these will probably be the most watched debates ever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they may be the most important and may be the most pivotal in the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Could I just add one thing?
Sure.
We've had a great discussion. But we've barely scratched the surface. I suspect a lot of your listeners would like to learn more about these proposals. And if you do want to learn more, just go to nolabels.org and you can learn just as much in just as much detail as
mm-hmm.
you'd like.
And let's touch on just one more point that you have here in ways to make Congress work. And I think this is a really interesting one. It's fix the filibuster, require real filibusters. Now, this is really interesting because we hear people talking all the time about the threat of a Republican filibuster, the threat of a Democratic filibuster. But you don't really see people actually standing up on the floor of the Senate and talking for 13 hours, you know, about their mom's apple pie recipe or reading through cookbooks or whatever, reading through the phone book or whatever. Mark McKinnon, why not? What has happened to the filibuster?
Well, that's a great point. And what's happening now is exactly what you said. It's just the threat of a filibuster. You don't even have to filibuster anymore. And that's precisely what our form says, that if you want a filibuster, you have to actually go on the floor and filibuster. When filibusters were initially adopted, I think that there were like one or two a year. And now I think Bill helped me on these numbers, but they're happening many, many times a week and have completely departed from the original idea of the filibuster. But, Bill, you probably have a little more history on it.
More than 100 per session now, which is extraordinary.
So it's just become a sort of move, a threat that doesn't get executed, but it's enough to sort of shut down debate.
That's right. And that's why we have a two-pronged proposal. First of all, we're not going to eliminate the filibuster, but you can no longer filibuster to prevent a piece of legislation from reaching the floor of the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to prevent it from passing, okay, you can try, but you cannot prevent the Senate from debating important questions. That's the first reform we're making. And secondly, no more virtual filibusters. If you want a filibuster, you have to be prepared to put your bodies across the railroad tracks of the legislative train and stop it that way.
Right.
You've got to take responsibility. You have to show up on the floor. You have to hold the floor. You have to do what Mr. Smith did when he famously went to Washington. So you really have to be prepared to take the responsibility for what you're doing in full view of the American people.
And a final question for both of you, since you've both been inside the White House. How frustrating is it, I wonder, for the staff, maybe for the president himself, inside the White House to sort of live with a Congress that maybe isn't in session a lot of the time, isn't coming to agreements on the budget, is having these filibusters, you know, is not approving, at one point we didn't get to, but is not taking up or down votes on the president's nominees for all sorts of different positions. How frustrating is that? Mark McKinnon, let me start with you.
Oh, it's unimaginably frustrating. I mean, you campaign for years and you get elected to the most important job in the world, and then you're completely handcuffed and you can't do anything. So that's why these reforms are needed. It's not just for one party or the other or one branch of government or the other. The idea is that by adopting a lot of these measures, it will just help grease the wheels and help people do the job that they're supposed to do.
And Bill Galston, you've been inside the Clinton White House. How frustrating is it from your perspective?
Well, I was involved in some of those nominations processes.
Right.
Frustrating doesn't begin to describe it, but it's worse than frustrating. It's dangerous. I'll give you an example. President Obama took office in early 2009 with an extraordinary economic crisis. And for months, he couldn't get the senior associates to the Secretary of Treasury approved by the Senate. Secretary of the Treasury, Tim Geithner, was home alone during one of the most critical periods our economy has faced in three quarters of a century. Mm. That is, you know, that goes beyond presidential frustration. That goes to the heart of what the president is responsible for in our system, and it cannot be allowed to continue.
We've been talking.
And just as an example,
yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I was appointed by President Bush to the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which oversees Radio Free Europe and other broadcasting entities of the United States government, and I never got confirmed in 3 years.
Hmm. Yeah, and that's one of the points, is just take a vote on people so that they know and they can either start their job or they can take themselves out of the process.
Yeah, find somebody else. Yeah.
Right. We've been talking about what it would take to turn our political system into something that really works. I've been speaking with Bill Galston, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and former aide to President Clinton. He is a co-founder of No Labels, as is Mark McKinnon, vice chairman of Hill and Knowlton Strategies, former advisor to George W. Bush. And you can find more at our website, wgbhnews.org, and at nolabels.org. Bill Galston and Mark McKinnon, thank you so much for this great discussion.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
And Callie Crossley, I see you're back in Studio 3.
Kara, we're going to leave the political utopia that you've been talking about and head back to reality by way of our New Hampshire insiders, Arnie Arneson and Fergus Cullen. We'll get an update on how the election is playing out in their swing state and also look at the Ron Paul factor at this week's RNC. I'm Callie Crossley.
And I'm Kara Miller. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.